from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of Campaign 2000, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Ellen Warren of the Chicago Tribune, Steve Neal of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Clifford Kelly of WVON Radio. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at America's only Radio Hall of Fame at the Museum of Broadcast Communications at the Chicago Cultural Center. This is a recorded program, so no phone calls tonight. However, if you'd like to email us a message, our email address is btbtalk@aol.com. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, our website address is www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, this is a very special show. Not only are we analyzing the campaign, which we knew we were going to do this about a couple of weeks ago, but we certainly did not realize that this was going to be such a historic night, and we will be with you for the next hour talking about the campaign that frankly won't go away. Ellen Warren of the Chicago Tribune joins us. Ellen, a question to you. How difficult is it going to be for the new president to govern, given the closeness of this race and the closeness of the House and the closeness of the Senate?
Well, no matter who wins, it's just the slenderest of margins. No mandate here. It's going to require vast amounts of cooperative effort and an awful lot of bipartisanship. Yeah.
Steve Neal of the Chicago Sun-Times joins us as well. Steve, what's your answer?
Bruce, I think that the new president, whoever it is, will be able to govern, but I agree with Ellen that it will take a lot. They will have to have a very collegial style to be able to work across the aisle. This has happened 16 times in our history, though, that a president has not won a majority of the popular vote, but it's been an awful long time since, if Bush goes on to win, that he hasn't had a majority, hasn't had a plurality of the popular vote.
Clifford Kelly of WVON Radio. Cliff, in this case, because it is so close, If there was a challenge, if either side decides they want to challenge what happens in the state of Florida or look around and challenge someplace else, will that be good or bad for politics?
It's going to be difficult, and I think there will be a challenge, Bruce. And to respond to your previous question, that same question you asked our panelist was asked to Governor Bush today. And when they asked him the question, how will you govern, having not gotten the popular vote, his response was he turned around and walked away. So he didn't have the answer that you folks have. I think there will be a challenge. I've been involved in election challenges, and the one situation that we're not looking at is, yes, you can count votes, but that has nothing to do with the irregularities that people are talking about. The things that where people voted in one of the counties for Buchanan when they thought they were voting for Gore. Some of the things about the police.
But once that begins in the state of Florida, because there is closeness in some other races as well, is it likely that there will be some examination elsewhere, for instance, in the state of Missouri, where a federal judge kept the polls open for three additional hours and then an appellate court judge closed it down?
What you normally have to show is that the number of affidavits that are submitted, if they are all upheld, would make a difference in the election itself. So unless you have that many people who are complaining, that would make up the distinction, the difference, rather, whether it would be a victory or a defeat. That makes the difference.
At this point, let's talk a little bit about the popular vote at the moment. Cliff has alluded to it. In the national popular vote at this moment, here are the latest figures. George Bush with 48,766,964. That's 48% of the vote. Al Gore in the lead with 48,934,659 at 49%, and Ralph Nader at 3% with 2,661,750. And in the Electoral College, that at this particular moment, that gives George Bush 246 Electoral College votes and Al Gore 260. And again, you need 270 to be president of the United States. And the state of Florida has 25 all by itself. Joining us now from his home in Tallahassee, Florida, is Marshall Baldwin. He is the host of Florida Radioactive on WTAL, the Beyond the Beltway affiliate in the capital of the Sunshine State. And Marshall, you're at the focal point of a lot of history in the making in Florida right at the moment. At this moment in time, where do things stand in the state of Florida?
As we speak right now, the Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, Republican, is in the process of conducting a statewide recount. State law requires a recount if the margin of victory in a race is 0.5% or less. The margin of victory in this race was about 0.03%, so the law was triggered. She plans to have the recount finished by close of business on Thursday, November 9th. You mentioned Ralph Nader, and I will just point out that right now the Bush margin of victory in this state as it stands now, 1,784 votes, is nowhere near Ralph Nader's vote total of 94,000 plus.
Question to you. At this moment, those that are involved in the process of not only the recount but a canvass, are they all elected officials? Are they appointed by Governor Jeb Bush? I mean, what is the politics of the people that are doing the counting right now?
The recount has overseers, okay, but the supervisors of election are the ones that have to do the recount county by county. The actual county reporting status as of yesterday was a complete 100%. So there were no outstanding ballots at the time of the end of the process. The only ballots that have not come in, I know I'm changing a little subject here, but the only ballots that have not come in are approximately 3,000 absentee ballots, most of which are from the military, and if history holds up from 1998, about 70% of those will go for Bush, so he can expect to gain over 2,000 votes in the next 10 days on absentees alone.
My question to you is, why does it take so long to count the absentee ballots?
Well, what happens is, by law, as long as the absentee ballot from overseas is postmarked by Election Day, November 7th, it must be accepted. You're dealing with the military mail service, and there's, you know, nothing worse than the bureaucracy called the mail than the bureaucracy, a double bureaucracy called the military mail.
Let me ask a question about the projection, because a lot of people last night were speculating, and I want to get reaction from everybody around the table, and then we'll give you the last word on it, Marshall. And that is, they're saying that because these people are in the military, it's more likely that they might vote for George Bush because of Republican conservative positions with the military. But also, there are a large number of African Americans in the military as well. So, Clifford, is it possible that everyone is sort of misconstruing how members of the service might vote?
I think you're absolutely right. There is a possibility that it might not be that much of a thing for Bush. And, you know, I think this is sort of a nutty law anyway. In fact, someone called my station this morning in the military and said Army Regulation 608-20 does not suggest that you can wait, that the vote should be there, just like our state law requires, in the polling jurisdiction at the time of the election. We vote absentee ballot here, but you must have those absentee ballots in the respective precincts on the day of the election.
I think, by the way, one of the reforms, and obviously we'll talk about the Electoral College a little bit later on in the program, but I think one of the reforms that comes out of this is that if you are an absentee, you're participating by absentee ballot, your ballot should be in, as they do in the state of Illinois, or even a day ahead of time.
Exactly.
Because one of the other things we have at the moment is that the state of Oregon, which of course, you know, is they're on the cusp of the new age of voting, by mail, and we haven't heard from them yet. So that's a reform that doesn't seem to be working. Steve Neal, what's your take on that particular point, or any question for Marshall?
What I was wondering about the absentees in Florida, would there be people who are like members of the Foreign Service or diplomats or other people, or is this just military?
Yeah, let me answer that. First of all, as to the question of the postmark date, has anybody ever heard of the Florida U.S. Senator Buddy McKay?
No.
The reason is that Buddy McKay was elected 12 years ago by the slimmest of majorities in the state of Florida. After the military absentees came in from overseas, you then had Senator Connie Mack, who has now served for 12 years and was just replaced by a Democrat, Bill Nelson.
Am I hearing you correctly, then, that it may take 10 days for all of these votes to come in?
It could take up to 10 days for all the absentees to come in. The recount of the physical vote in the state of Florida is supposed to be done by close of business tomorrow. As to the military voting in 1998, the Republican Party in this state helped to generate about 100,000 absentee ballot requests, many to military voters. Mm-hmm. About 70% of those voted Republican. There's no reason to think they wouldn't switch this.
What is, by the way, just because we're going to have to move on, but my last question to you is, you know, and I was a little bit stupefied that when I was, watching, switching around at least, after midnight last night to the major networks, very few people uttered a word about the fact that Jeb Bush is the governor of Florida, and he obviously is George W. Bush's brother. Where is he at the moment, and are people keeping a close eye on him?
He is in a back room hovering over a mimeograph machine, cranking out ballots as quickly as possible. No, I'm just kidding.
I think we have a new lead.
Marshall, what's he really doing?
Let me answer that by answering another quick question. You mentioned a confusing ballot in Palm Beach County.
Right.
The supervisor of elections in Palm Beach County is an elected Democrat. I've got that ballot posted on FloridaRadioactive.com. It's not confusing at all if you can read English. The arrows clearly point to who you're supposed to vote for. Another interesting thing that happened in Leon County, another very strong Democratic county, the Democrats in this county were 40 minutes late turning in lists of get-out-the-vote workers. Those were all disqualified by state law, by a Democratic supervisor of elections, and the Democratic vote wasn't quite as high in North Florida as it could have been as a result. So you've really got two Democratic supervisors of elections following the rules, creating ballots, enforcing laws, and if the Democrats want to blame anybody for any confusion, they need to blame their own elected officials.
Well, that may well be. If a voter is disenfranchised, it matters not what political affiliation the perpetrator has. But we had Congressman Al C. Hastings on this morning, Marshall, from the 23rd District in Florida.
We've had him on. Yes, we've liked him.
Great. And he mentioned the fact that they had police checkpoints. You had state policemen out checking people, whether they have a driver's license and so forth, who were going to a church where there were three precincts. What do you think about that sort of thing? And also, there was a mention of some boxes missing, some polling boxes missing.
Okay, the polling boxes that were missing, that was a rumor. We have disavowed that. The other one we're chasing down. I've got other anecdotal evidence from around the state about a few Republicans who are complaining. In North Florida, they're complaining about the Democrats handing out illegal sample ballots at the polling place. All of these things, I think, will balance out. None of them are going to invalidate this election unless you have all the sharks that swim offshore come into the state as lawyers and decide to cause trouble. However, that's what's going to balance out.
That could happen. Yeah. Listen, Marshall, on that note, we're going to say farewell to you. I thank you very much. That's Marshall Baldwin, who was the host of Florida Radioactive, and he has a website, FloridaRadioactive.com, which has the latest results from the state of Florida. We thank you very much from our affiliate, WTAL, in Tallahassee, Florida. In a campaign, especially one where it's very close, there are scores of decisions that will be wrestled about, that will be debated about, that people will like to have back. Second-guessing will go on for years in this campaign. Steve Neal, if you had to make the decisions in the campaign on either side, what changes would you make that you think would have led to an avoidance of where we are right now?
Well, I think the Democrats made an error in trying to demonize Ralph Nader. I think they should have embraced him. Gore has a good record on the environment. They did not need to be enemies. When Nader started out, he was about three-fourths against Bush, and they made him into about three-fourths against Gore. And in fact, and I think that the Democrats did that. Now, at the same time, I think that President Clinton is probably the most talented politician I've ever seen. Great speaker, great motivator. Now, there is still some controversy around him. I saw in one of the exit polls that 60% of the voters had something of a negative opinion of him personally. But at the same time, they approve of many of his policies. And so I think that they did miss a bet, particularly in a state like his home state of Arkansas, where I think that he would have made a difference. And so I think that the misuse of President Clinton was very costly.
Ellen, where do you think the mistakes were made?
Well, I think it's probably too late to have said they should have abolished the Electoral College, which is just, you know, try and explain this election to somebody who doesn't live here. I mean, it's just startling. I tried to tell my 18-year-old son about the Electoral College.
But everybody knew the rules going in.
Well, right.
So, I mean, you can't change it now.
Were there
some major screw-ups by either side that you think led to the closeness of this race?
Because
at the beginning of this race, I mean, first of all, if you go back a year, George Bush was way ahead.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, in the last several months, people have been saying, hey, with the economy like this, why isn't this guy way ahead? So what's your answer?
Well, why isn't this guy way ahead? I can't answer that question. But I disagree with Steve Neal. I don't think that embracing Nader would have made a big difference. And I genuinely think that, you know, they made a calculated decision based on what a turnoff in the morality column Bill Clinton is. And I think they were probably, you know, it was a crapshoot as to whether he was a plus or a minus. And I'm not at all sure he would have helped the guy. Maybe he would have helped him in Arkansas, and that could have been the margin of victory. I don't know. But I'm not, you know, I suspect that if you asked Gore today if he could take back those decisions, would he take them back? I'm not at all sure he'd change his mind.
I think you ran a horrible campaign. I agree with Steve. If it wasn't for the 22nd Amendment, Clinton would be elected again to a third term.
I think he would have been,
yeah,
too.
Absolutely.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right.
Absolutely. So use it.
So did Bill
Daley not to use it.
Did Bill Daley blow it, or did he make it close?
I think Bill Daley blew it. I think he blew it. I also think
I don't think that was Bill Daley's calling.
Well,
it was
whoever
Al Gore's
call. Let me tell you, whoever was running his campaign in the primary should have continued to run it in the general election. Donna Brazile is an in-your-face type of person. The Gore that I saw against Bradley is the Gore that should have been against Bush, and he was not. I sat there and watched those confrontations, and I couldn't believe what he allowed this character to get away with, talking about military, you know, just things such as...
But again, do we have something as basic? If we're talking about one state, I mean, in this particular case, you can make the case that Al Gore lost, again, if the results hold in Florida, you can make the case that Al Gore lost the presidency because he lost Florida, and he lost Florida because of Ralph Nader. Or... Did he lose Florida by selecting Joe Lieberman? Joe Lieberman make it close? Because again, if you know, 3 or 4 months ago before the convention, I think Steve and I, you know, we chatted about it. If you talk to most political pros, they thought that Al Gore was going to select Senator Bob Graham of Florida to be his running mate. And I'll tell you right now, if Graham had been the running mate, Al Gore would have carried Florida.
Right.
And been the next president.
That's right. And if Lieberman was supposed to help in New York, he may have, but it wasn't that great. It was only about 60%, they say, of the Jewish vote.
And a Democrat doesn't need help in New York.
That's correct. So I agree. I think that was... And also, I think it was a bad selection for Lieberman, and we mentioned this. There's a lot of people who, particularly in the Bible Belt, who did not feel that was a good selection. I've talked to people down there, and they did not want.
But those are southern states are states that would have gone for the Republican candidate, regardless of the religion of the vice president.
I think Arkansas definitely could have been saved, just for one.
All right, here's another question. We mentioned Arkansas. Obviously, one of the big stories is that George Bush carried Arkansas and Tennessee. Did we see the revenge factor play because George Bush spent so much time? He really wanted to win those two states and sort of stick it to Clinton Gore?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, what a commentary it is that Al Gore can't carry his home state. I mean, it's just... you couldn't even say that about Mondale. Remember, Mondale carried one state, but at least it was his home state.
Steve, did the press underreport maybe the revenge aspect of this campaign?
Bruce, I don't know. I think that George W. Bush felt a strong motive because of his father's defeat in 1992. There's still a lot of bitterness about that. But I think he also, I don't think Bush ran that bad a campaign. I mean, the fact is, look at Mike Dukakis' campaign. It was a similar circumstance. Mike Dukakis carried 10 states. George Bush, what is he going to wind up with? About 30 states and maybe the next president. So I think he ran a very good campaign.
We're talking about Campaign 2000, the campaign that won't go away. I'm Bruce Dumont from the Chicago Cultural Center. Thank you for joining us tonight on this special edition of Beyond the Beltway here on WYCC Channel 20.
Dumont back from the Chicago Cultural Center. Thank you very much for joining us tonight on this special edition of Beyond the Beltway, talking about the campaign that's not quite over yet, although we do know that Republicans have retained control of the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. It is very, very tight. Actually, the Senate is tied at 50-50 at this particular moment. So that means, talking about how governing might change, it is the vice president that presides over the Senate, which means that if George Bush is the next president of the United States, it means that Dick Cheney will sit in that chamber, and he will be somewhat bogged down, won't he? I mean, vice presidents usually can go out, they can do funerals, they can do a lot of stuff. It was sort of suspected that expected that Dick Cheney would perhaps be a real strong advisor on foreign affairs for President Bush. So let's just take a look at the practical nature of the role of the vice president. He's bogged down in
the
Senate.
Well, au contraire. I think he actually gives the vice president, if in fact Cheney became vice president and was the tiebreaker here in the Senate, it would give him something to do. Bravo. You know, look at Al Gore. He's been running for president as vice president for a couple of years here. And so we, in effect, didn't have a vice president. The vice president doesn't have a job.
Well, yeah, but he can have a job. Gore had a job. I mean, because the president gave him a lot of things to do. He assigned him certain tasks.
You know, the Senate's not voting every day, for goodness sake.
No, but my point is, I think he would be sort of bogged down. What do you think, Steve?
No, I think it would make the job more of a challenge. And Gore did cast that one important vote in deficit reduction package.
Sure.
For the most part, I agree with Ellen. Vice presidents don't do a whole lot, although Gore did have more responsibility than most. Mm-hmm. And it is the vice president is valuable chiefly for a young guy like Gore to use it to run for president.
Exactly.
Cheney's an old guy.
I want to get back to my opening question, and that is, what does it mean for the country because this race is so close?
I saw on a lot of people on CNN the other day were asked that question, if in fact the president wins the Electoral College vote and does not win the popular vote, what do you think? And every one of them said, that is horrible, it's a terrible thing in a democracy. Obviously, the majority should rule. Now, I don't know who these people were for, because I think most people felt if this happened, it would be the reverse. That's the way
absolutely.
I felt. Yeah.
Everybody thought that.
A lot of these people, I'm sure, say, well, it's okay at this point.
But the reality is, again, for the sake of this discussion, we're assuming, and we don't know yet, but we're assuming for the sake of this discussion that George Bush becomes the president-elect,
mm-hmm.
and then he becomes the president. And he has a 50-50 split in the Senate, and he has a very narrow margin in the House of Representatives. It's the first time since 1953 to 1955 that the presidency, the House, and the Senate all controlled by the Republicans. It's been a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you, Ellen, can he govern?
Yes.
Because one of the alleged strengths of George Bush is that he's a legislative wheeler and dealer that can get things done. But he's been dealing with Democrats in Texas, which are a little bit different than the Democrats in Washington.
I have no question that he can govern. Will he have to bend? Will he have to have a collegial relationship with the Democrats? You bet. But I do not see, this kind of wither democracy question is kind of fun to discuss, but I don't think it's much of a problem. I think that, George Bush ran on the platform of, I'm a get-along kind of a guy. I can get along with everybody. And, I just don't see it as a big problem. Sure, it's a situation we haven't seen for a while. But in many respects, I think it's probably not a minus.
Is it likely, though, that you will see a lot of Democrats take an obstructionist position, because they may feel that if we can keep this guy on the ropes for a couple of years, we'll have another shot at the Senate, we'll have another shot at the House, and we can wrest control here.
Bruce, I don't know. The Republicans thought they could do that in 1994, and they wound up reelecting Bill Clinton and misinterpreting their mandate. I do think that Dick Gephardt and Tom Daschle are capable of, working with the Republican president. I do think, though, that if Bush is, in fact, the next president, that he would be wise to take the lead in embracing the movement to get rid of the Electoral College and to make democracy work, because I do think this is an anachronism, And I don't. I mean, we intervened in the Philippines when Corazon Aquino won the vote and said this wasn't right. Now, Marcos actually, I think, did try to steal that election. It was a little different than this, but I still think that the time has come to do something about this old system.
I think it's going to be very interesting what he does. The Texas Truth Squad, which nobody wanted to print anything about, those are four sitting legislators, say that Bush was lying and all the things he said relative to what he did with the Texas legislature was in fact untrue. The people who really run the House, for instance, which is odd, are people from his own state that he hid. You would never know they existed.
Right.
Tom DeLay and Dick Armey are going to do what they want to do. They, particularly Tom DeLay, one of the most despicable people, according to the folks who work with him, he's going to be telling George Bush what to do. It's not going to go the other way around. And I think,
Cliff, I don't know. Last summer at the convention, you didn't see too much of those guys, and I do think
right. That
one of the reasons why the Republican Party in this state has shrunk. I mean, this state went Republican six straight times between 68 and 88, and is now now a Democratic stronghold for president because of folks like the gentleman that you named.
But they're still there. They're still
true.
There, Steve, and what you saw at the convention would look like a night at the Apollo. I mean, that was the biggest sham going until you looked at who the delegates were, and then, of course, they were practically lily white. But what happened, just for those of you who, what happened was Bush made a deal with Bullock, you know, the lieutenant governor.
Exactly,
who did not want Ann Richards around. That's how he, I mean, that's the reason he's sitting in the governor's
chair. One of the other things about this campaign, if they're, I made a list of winners and losers, and I want to get, you know, nominations from everybody before we go off the air this evening, but obviously Hillary Rodham Clinton was
big
a
winner.
Big winner. She was almost, you know, sort of usurped by what was happening after she won because of the back and forth on the presidential campaign, but clearly there are already people that think that she is the titular head of the Democratic Party, and yet, because of the closeness of this race, is there a future for Al Gore? Are we moving into an era when we're going to see Hillary Rodham Clinton and Al Gore continue to sort of battle with each other or jockey with each other for the leadership of the Democratic Party for the next 4 years, in your view, Ellen Warren?
Okay, well, if Al Gore is not president, then where is his podium from whence to speak? He's just an ex-vice president, whereas Hillary...
But if he is the person who won the popular vote, and a lot of people, obviously they're going to remember this. I mean, you know, you talk about a civics lesson about the importance of your vote. This is that lesson tenfold.
Mm-hmm.
My question is he someone that is a viable political commodity, or does he fade away?
I think he's absolutely viable. I mean, Nixon in 1960 almost won. That election was probably stolen from Nixon in 1960. 1968, Hubert Humphrey came very close. He almost had a second chance in 1972. And so I absolutely believe Al Gore has a future. I think he did well he was counted out in about six polls on the day of the election.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that Hillary is going to be around, and she's a factor. And had Gore lost badly, she would have been the undisputed front runner for next time. But I think Al Gore deserves another chance.
I think what a lot of people look at, though, folks, is the fact that with the unprecedented economy and all the things that are going on, well, and if you can't convince someone that you are a team member of this and let's continue this wonderful society that's been going, something is drastically wrong. And I'm not sure people are going to look at Gore as a viable candidate.
When we look at all of these numbers, what role did impeachment and Bill Clinton play? Because although you said earlier that if Bill Clinton had gone out and campaigned that he might have been a plus, a lot of the polls, one of which you suggested was for independents, Bill Clinton was the albatross around Al Gore's neck. And so Al Gore was a victim of impeachment.
Except at the same time, I think it cut both ways. I think that Clinton brought younger voters into the Democratic Party like Reagan did to the Republicans. And
he brought them into the White House, which got him
correct.
In trouble.
And no, but Clinton helped.
Well, won anyhow.
Yeah. I don't recall. No, Bill Clinton, I agree with Cliff, would have won re-election had he been eligible this year. and that Gore is just not as good a campaigner as Bill Clinton.
And two of the House managers of the impeachment process lost their seats.
Well,
Logan and McCollum.
And a lot of people wouldn't admit to pollsters that Clinton fatigue was a factor in their votes because they don't want to seem like they're echoing delay.
On that subject, you mentioned the impeachment. Obviously, the chairman, Henry Hyde, had the strongest challenge he's had in a long time, right. And yet he won by a comfortable margin. But in the Senate, the members of the Senate that lost, Senate Republicans who voted no on impeachment, all won.
Mm-hmm.
Those Republicans who lost yesterday all voted yes in some very,
that
very close races.
That shows you what people think. Yes, exactly.
You know, you're trying to draw, I think, some logical conclusions that aren't necessarily logical here. We say that
I do that all the time.
Well, and you know, keep up the good work. But I think that you got to understand that, yeah, Clinton probably would have won a third term if he were eligible, and yet Gore still can be tainted by the moral scourge that is Bill Clinton.
But look what he's saying, though.
And
the
also,
people who,
it doesn't
something,
make sense.
I will say,
well,
something also that you will probably all jump down my throat on. Had the Democrats dumped, had they voted to convict Bill Clinton 2 years ago, Al Gore would have been the incumbent president, and he would have been elected to a full four-year term yesterday.
I agree with that.
So the Democrats may try to have it both ways, and they end up with 2 years instead.
Well, I think they thought they would have. I think they thought they would have had a candidate who would have been able to take advantage of the great economy and things that have been going on through the Clinton Gore years.
One person, by the way, that in the last month of the campaign has been, sort of dominated was Ralph Nader, and. There was an onslaught against Ralph Nader by Democrats, a heavily orchestrated campaign to besmirch his reputation, to basically say he didn't have a role to play. He was the Green Party candidate for president. And again, if you look at those polls, certainly in the state of Florida, he is the difference between winning and losing in that state. Had he not been on the ballot, it is, I think, clear to me at least, that that Al Gore would have won that state. Mm-hmm. Dan Johnson Weinberger is with us this evening. He is the state coordinator for Ralph Nader. And a lot of Democrats are looking to Ralph Nader and pointing a finger and saying, you're the reason that George Bush may be the next president. You've heard it before, but now, Dan, it's reality. How do you feel today?
Well, I feel sad for the Democrats that they nominated the most conservative candidate in the last 50 years. I think they shot themselves in the foot. And I agree with Steve Neal that by antagonizing Ralph Nader, they really hurt their cause. I think if they had embraced his issues, I think Al Gore could have won. It would have been really easy for Al Gore to take a lot of the wind out of the sails of the Nader campaign by being more of a progressive. But he wasn't. He was a very conservative candidate. And I think
during the primary, he was challenged by Bill Bradley, who was a very strong progressive challenge to him, certainly in the area of race relations and a lot of other things. I mean, he was saying things that no candidate who's run in any time in my memory has spoken. And yet, Bill Bradley was summarily dismissed in that campaign by Democratic primary voters. They had an opportunity to have a more progressive candidate. Certainly the African-American community didn't support him, even though he probably went further on race relations than anybody. So, I mean, if the Democrats wanted a progressive, they could have had one, but they chose not to, Dan.
Sure. I mean, part of that is the power of the machines that all backed Gore and all the establishment power within the Democratic Party that lined up behind Gore in the primaries. I'm not saying it's a bad or, evil decision that the primary voters chose Gore over Bradley. I just think it was a mistake. And I think Gore didn't have to present himself as a conservative Democrat. He could have presented himself as a more progressive candidate. So, I think it was a mistake that the Democrats made, and I don't mean a few people in Washington. You know, it's a fair point that the primary voters selected him, but then that blame, I think, falls on the shoulders of Gore, his campaign managers, and all the primary voters that backed him.
Well, I think Mr. Nader is very pleased. I had him on my show, and he said he was running to win, and I said, you've got about as much chance of winning as I do. I said, what's your real mission? He says, to galvanize his base. And I said, fine, so you'd be better off with a Bush administration. And he said, yes, that's true. So he got his wish, maybe.
He was also looking for 5%, and he didn't get that.
And I'm glad he didn't.
So he's not going to get better.
I'm glad
funding.
He didn't for the following. And I can also, we mark the tape. When I asked him about his money, his personal finances, he said that he got all of his money through writing and speaking. I said, well, I think you were involved in the stock market. And he said, yes, that's true. So my question was, I said, so you have benefited by the same system that you attack on a daily basis. His response was amazing. He says, sometimes it's good to get your enemies to pay your fare. So it's unfortunate, and I believe in multi-parties. I think we should have third parties. But the only way you're really going to do it and do it right is to get rid of the Electoral College.
Well, if you really want to get rid of it, you should start following some of the Nader platform on political reform. And that's, A, should require the winner. The president should earn a majority of votes. And neither Al Gore nor George Bush has done so. They've only earned a plurality. And that's a real problem. Secondly, we should use proportional representation for elect our legislatures. If we want multi-parties, if we want third parties to get elected, it's easy to do if we just follow the same systems as most other
countries. Well, evidently, he wasn't the one to bring the message, because look what Ross Perot was able to get, 19%, and this guy could only get... You know, Gloria Steinem said, the comment, she used to back Nader. He thinks, he's like De Gaulle is France. He's the movement. He's not.
That's not true at all.
Well, that's what a lot of... Evidently, a lot of the voters felt that, because he certainly didn't do well.
But again, what we have here, and last week I went up to Milwaukee. I had an opportunity to ask Ralph Nader that question at a press conference. And basically it was that in third-party movements, they may start with a good idea or two, and then they become a personality. It becomes a personality cult situation, whether it's George Wallace, John Anderson, Ross Perot, or this year Ralph Nader. Then the election is held, they lose, and then they tend to fade away because they are unable to continue to garner the media, and if they don't personally stay there, they don't have anybody that they can pass it off to. In other words, Ralph Nader has access to television because he's a good talker. He's been an international figure for the last 30 years. Ross Perot got it because he was a billionaire. They didn't call him wacky. He was eccentric. George Wallace was a showbiz. He was racist when he was running for president, but he had a showbiz flair about him. Without that, you have Harry Brown and you have the Libertarians,
although
that get nowhere in the national debate.
Although Ralph Nader, like a Norman Thomas or a La Follette, done a lot of important things, substantial guy. Third-party candidates are healthy for the system, and I didn't hear people trying to get Ross Perot out of the race in 1992.
But also,
President Bush's reelection.
The reality is that they can't win, though, which is something that Pat Buchanan, said today in a press conference that he finally realized that third-party candidacies really are going to go nowhere.
Well, what did he do with 12 million?
He discovered that after he got his 12 million.
Right.
I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back on a special edition of Beyond the Beltway, coming to you tonight on WYCC Channel 20. Clifford Kelly of WVON Radio, Ellen Warren, who writes the Ink column, along with Terry Armour for the Chicago Tribune, and Steve Neal of the Chicago Sun-Times joined me tonight in discussing the campaign, some of which is over. But, of course, the big question is what's going to happen in the state of Florida with a recount down there, and we're expecting to have a resolution to that at maybe in the next 24 hours. But earlier in the program, we said that some of those absentee ballots, it may be 10 days to a couple of weeks before we get the final results in that particular race. I want to talk about one of the other, I think, huge stories of this campaign, and that is we talked earlier about a turning point. I think I would argue that the debates were a turning point, because the expectations were very high for Al Gore in those debates. George Bush met the expectations, probably won at least a couple of them. And also another turning point, I think, frankly, was when he came to Chicago. It was during a time when the polls were in a dive. It was when he came to Chicago and did the Oprah Winfrey show. I think that was a turning point in the campaign, because that's when he was introduced to a lot of people, especially female voters that may not have had an understanding of who he was. And I thought he did a good job on that show. Gore did a pretty good job the week before, but I thought that that's where the turnaround began.
I wouldn't argue with you, Bruce, but I would say that, while the turning point may have been in part the debates, but not only because Gore did pretty well, Bush did pretty well, but also Gore really, I think, did himself some damage by making us wonder which one of these guys, in the course of these three debates, which one is the real Gore? Is he, is he the pouncer? Is he the pussycat? I mean, who is this guy? I think that voters were confused by the different persona that we saw.
You agree with that, Steve?
Yes, but I think, I mean, Al Gore is one of the best debaters I've ever seen. He's smart. He talks in whole paragraphs. I thought in the first debate that he mopped up the floor with Bush, who seemed ill-informed and intellectually lazy. And the polls showed that the next morning when you ask who won the debate. But the American people focus on the size and the rolling the eyes. I just thought that was Gore being Gore. He actually seemed much more respectful to Bill Bradley, as Cliff was noting in the primaries.
They won the Bush people won the spin.
But I thought two things in the debates. I thought Rick Lazio going over and getting in Hillary Clinton's face assured that he would lose that race. Right. He fell from being even to way behind, and I thought deservedly so. And then the other one in the last debate, where I thought Gore did pretty well in the last debate, but he goes over and gets in Bush's face. I think a lot of people thought he looked like a jerk.
Let me just respond to this. I think that he did not go. You know, attacking someone's record, Steve, is
it's fair game.
Exactly, and he didn't even do that. I agree with in your paper in the Sun-Times, Roger Ebert says his performance in the debates, meaning Bush, proves Bush doesn't have intellectual capacity to occupy the Oval Office. Republican presidential Bush fielded questions during the debates with abstract evasions and meaningless phrases. I said that, and then the spin, as you mentioned, Bruce, that's what did it. Because there's no way that this man could have won those debates.
Here's what happened. There were some people that brought up, you know, the capacity issue. But the other thing that happened in that first debate was that little statement by Al Gore about having gone down to the flood with somebody from FEMA and being there to offer his, you know, compassionate support for someone. And it turned out that was not true. That's not who we met with. And what it did, it exacerbated the issue that Al Gore exaggerated. And what was happened from that point on, they put Al Gore on the defensive. And this is why they won the spin, because the polls instantly after the debate suggested that Gore did do well in debate number one. But what happened was they put Gore on the defensive, and frankly, I don't think he ever, you know, reacted from that, because there were other instances before that and after that where there was some exaggeration involved.
But the Gore people should have come out then and attacked all of the fabrications that have emanated from George Bush's camp.
They should have.
About what he did and so forth and so on, about the military, where he disappeared.
That came late.
But it came late, but it should have come at that time, and it should have been directed to him. It never was.
Why didn't they do it?
I think they had focus groups that showed Al Gore has a problem. A lot of people, Cliff, I think, think he's mean, even though, as you say, when you hit exactly. something on the record, right. that is valid.
Exactly.
And when you talk about policy, and there are clear policy differences between these two guys.
We are told that they knew about his DUI, that the Gore people knew about it. And it's not the 24.
Of course they knew about it.
Sure they knew it. Why didn't they bring it up? It's not the 24 years.
You think they knew about it well in advance?
Oh, yes, that's what I'm saying. It's not the 24 years. It's the fact that he wouldn't respond to it. It's the cover-up.
Why didn't they?
And then when they ask his spokesperson, a newsman, ask her, well, has the governor had any problems with any other substance abuse? Well, you know, he's done bad things. When they pushed Clinton to say that, I didn't
Cliff,
inhale.
Here's the point. Cliff, here is the point. I've said this for years, and I think you've been on the program and you've agreed with it, that when you're measuring who is going to be a good president, it is not wrong to measure the way they manage their campaign. And what we have here, as you alluded to in your mm-hmm. response to the first question,
right.
we have one campaign that was managed very well, and we have another that missed opportunities,
right.
not exclusively because of the actions of the candidate, but there were some missed calls on this.
I don't disagree. I think one of the things, just to get back to the whole issue of debate.
So Bush didn't win it, Gore blew it.
Exactly. That's my feeling.
I don't think Gore was that bad a candidate. No, I think Gore waged, I think Gore, starting with his speech at the Democratic convention, great speech,
mm-hmm.
Fought back. and focusing on the issue of, like, Social Security, yep. which
it was the best 2 weeks
helped.
Of the campaign.
It was.
Yes.
So I think
right.
Gore did some good things. It is very tough for any party to win three times in a row. And so I think that Gore deserves some credit for waging a good campaign.
But I think he blew it, Steve, when we were all looking for something in the debates, or whatever you call them. They weren't debates, but I thought he really blew that because he, even though he won, and I agree
well,
with
well,
you.
Well, if you go back read those transcripts, I mean, he
won.
He
you're
really,
right. But he could have done it in a way where it would have been difficult for the spin masters to even.
If.
Well,
you know, and,
sure,
and
well,
he didn't do it. He needed a knockout.
I mentioned earlier, I made a list of my winners and losers,
okay.
and we've only gotten to about two or three of them. But at the top of my list of losers, you'll be my judge here, exit pollsters. Are they the biggest losers?
They look like idiots. They look like fools.
Without a doubt.
No, there's a bigger loser than that.
Who?
John Ashcroft.
Well...
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I didn't put him as a winner. I didn't put Mrs.
Well,
Carnahan as a winner. You can't say that.
When you lose, when you lose to someone who's on the ticket who's dead and everybody knows it, that's a pretty big loss.
So I think TV pundits, you have to say, are the biggest losers because they relied on exit polls that were just wrong and they looked absolutely idiotic, calling Florida, taking it back, you know.
Declaring Bush the winner and then taking that back.
Is the embarrassment of last night, is it going to affect the future in any way?
I think it may, although exit polls have always been wrong. I remember people being elected to the Senate, they said, and
yes.
who weren't, and California being awarded to wrong people, Mo Udall being given the Wisconsin primary years ago when he lost the next morning. So exit polls are often wrong.
Now, the media polls, we could say this time, most of them were pretty right because they said it was neck and neck, and in some cases a dead heat.
Except,
so the media polls were more accurate than the exit polls, at least in the last two cycles, that was not the case.
Well, and Zogby, once again, who called the Bob Dole Clinton vote the most accurate, appears to have been the most accurate. Again, he was the only one on election day, the morning of election day, that showed Gore up by
we
two
have
points.
Another point here is the billions of dollars that were spent in this campaign at all levels, all people running for office. But it seems to me that when you look at the United States Senate, three of the people that I would describe as winners yesterday, one was John Corzine, the new senator-elect from New Jersey, Mark Dayton, the new senator-elect from Minnesota, who knocked off Rob Grams, a takeaway for the Republicans, and Maria Cantwell out in Washington, who took a Republican seat of Slade Gordon. You have three. In the Corzine case, here is one man who spent $60 million of his own money to become a United States senator. You have Mark Dayton spending about $11 million. You have Maria Cantwell spending close to $8 million of her own money. These are Democrats. These are allegedly the people of the people. Now, do we have a serious image problem with the party in the Senate when you add this group to Ted Kennedy and Rockefeller and John Kerry, Mr. Democrat? Cliff Kelly?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think
so,
there's an image problem here?
No, I think everybody understands the fact that if you are in the U.S. Senate, you're a millionaire. It doesn't matter what party you belong to. You're not going to be there.
Not all of them.
Now, who isn't?
Rick Santorum, I don't think
Dick
is.
Durbin.
Yeah. Dick Durbin
okay,
isn't.
That's true.
But this goes back
is
to...
Is there a problem here?
Yes. This is all because of that federal, one of the worst rulings by the Supreme Court in the so-called Buckley decision, which allows people of wealth to put unlimited resources into their campaign to buy seats in the Senate like a hobby, like you're buying a new car. And it's a absurd ruling that McCain-Feingold would do much to close that loophole and to have a limit of $50,000 to which you could give to your own campaign. And then maybe you'd get people of you'd get more diversity in the Senate rather than all these rich people that are looking for a hobby,
and I agree,
or having a midlife crisis.
I think there should be a limit as to how much you can contribute to your own campaign,
mm-hmm.
regardless of what your political affiliation is. I think that's totally wrong.
You also had a takeaway in Michigan. Debbie Stabenow is the new senator elect. She knocked off the only Arab American in the United States Senate, Spencer Abraham, who was a first termer running for re-election. Jim Talent, who everyone thought for the last several months would be the new Republican governor of Missouri. He was lost in sort of the sympathy vote for Mel Carnahan, and Bob Holden became the new governor-elect of Missouri. That surprised a lot of people. Jean Shaheen reelected as the governor of New Hampshire. It's hard to get reelected governor there, but she did it. One of now five women who are governors throughout the United States. A good night for women. They won. They won some big seats. Maria Cantwell now joins Patty Murray as a state that has two female U.S. senators. A good night.
Ten women in the Senate.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, bravo! Yippee!
And of course, Robert Byrd, Ron. There's a real surprise. We also have a situation where when you look at at what has to be done now. And again, as we, close in on the remaining 5 minutes of our broadcast this evening, we are still waiting on word from Florida as to what the final verdict of the pollsters down there, the vote counters, not the pollsters, what it will all mean. But I want to go back to the opening of our conversation and talk, because you have people on both sides. In any campaign, the emotions become very, very high. And I come back to whether or not we have the capacity, we as the voters, as people who supported one candidate or the other, do we have the capacity to be able to move into an era of bipartisanship? I want to give everybody about 10 seconds to give me a quick answer on that. Can we do that?
Ellen Warren. I think the answer is yes, and I don't think we have much choice. The election's over, and one of these guys is going to be president, and we move on.
Steve.
I think the American people want that.
I think the American people want it. I'm not sure it'll happen, Steve. Bruce. It depends on what comes forth from this administration, whoever it is.
But again, we have, regardless of what the final result is, we do have two good communicators, at least in a television sense, and they're going to have to rally the country, and they're going to have to lick a few wounds and try to heal a lot of wounds that are really become open sores, especially in a close race. On that moment, we are out of time. Clifford Kelly, Morning Man on WVON Radio, has joined us. Steve Neal of the Chicago Sun-Times. Steve, always nice to have you with us. And Ellen Warren, who writes the Ink column along with Terry Armour in the Chicago Tribune. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us for this special edition of Beyond the Beltway. Good night, everybody.